All right. Hello and welcome, everybody. This is the first episode of the Operant Chamber. This is a special edition of the Tipsy Unicorn podcast. Today, I am happy to be welcoming Polly, goes by Polly Gloves. And we're going to be talking about leadership in education. So, Polly, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about, you know, your background, kind of what what drives you in this area?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on. And I'm honored to be like the first on the Opera Chamber. That's very cool. So thank you. And Abby, I got to, as you know, listen to kind of like your origin podcast. And when you were speaking about some of your experience in education, I could relate so much. I had like deep empathy for you and sympathy because I've been there. I've experienced it. And so I'll, you know, to share a little bit about that stuff. But for me, I guess, you know, I was growing up, I got bullied a little bit, not near what other people, you know, however they were bullied. And I ended up like feeling a real disdain for bullies, large disdain. And when I was 14 years old, neighborhood bully, you know, I had gotten a knife held to my throat, like beat up a few times and this and that and the other, you know. So I lived in fear and I lived, felt humiliation because I ran. I remember running from a bully one time and like that feeling just made me feel like just like a less than, you know, as a human being. And so the last time this guy tried to bully me, I felt like I'd rather die. It's a terrible place to be, you know, than allow myself to be bullied. I never turned back. I mean, you don't get into, I'm a boxer, you know, and a mixed martial artist. So you don't go into the fight game usually unless you're like, you know, you're really broke and it's all you have. Because it's dangerous, you know, to do it. But I had a lot of fuel. So I mentioned that because I've carried that like kind of fighting spirit on into the professional world. And I look at leadership. And I think there are some really good leaders in the world and in the organizations that I've worked in. And I think they can make such a positive difference in the lives of so many people. On the other hand, I've run across a number of really poor leadership and poor leaders. And they've made life miserable for people. And for example, in education, I've heard people say, you know, time and time again, do it for the students. But listen, you cannot, to me, it's a cop out. I'm not saying that they're all cop outs, right? And I believe in the end, we need to be there for the students, but you cannot make it about the students without making it about the adults in the building, right? Because they're bringing out the best in students, you got to bring out the best in adults. And so this kind of blame game that happens in education a lot, it like trickles downhill. It's like shit rolling downhill, you know? I write about it in one of my books, Deliberate Coaching, it's like not okay. And I believe, a lot of times I believe it's good people engaging in bad behavior, you know? And so that's why I ended up writing my last book, Positional Authority Ain't Leadership, because I've seen so many people doing things that were harmful in the name of student achievement, right? So I think after seeing that so many times and after participating in a number of school turnarounds in very challenging areas, right? High crime areas, high poverty, Title I schools, schools with lots of students with disabilities, that we were able to successfully turn those around. I will say it wasn't lasting, you know, sustainability is an issue because as soon as we left, you know, the systems that we had put in place and the behaviors weren't institutionalized and we wanted to stay, but the district wanted us to go into other places and make some of those changes. So that's sad for the kids. It's sad for the adults in the building and things ended up kind of going back to where they were. But the good news is that we can make a change. We're all equipped, you know, if you're in the field, we're equipped with the science of the science of human behavior. And I find that Abby, too often in our field, people forget about the science when it comes to interacting with other adults, right? I hear people saying, you hear it all over again, you know, do it for the learner, you know, got to make it about the learner. And as soon as somebody like the RBT is not performing or BCBA is not performing to a standard, somebody in the field is not doing it, we start blaming, we start pointing fingers, we start saying they're this and they're that, we start name calling. And I'm like, you know, I think if you start doing that, you are now suffering from what I like to call behavioral myopia. You're not looking at it from a behavioral analytic lens because there's a reason they're doing it. Now, we're all humans. We have our own history, right? So if you're experiencing that stuff, we're responding emotionally. I do it all the time, right? I talk about that in the book. By the way, the subtitle of the book, which is fun, which you know, the last one is Positional Authority, Ain't Leadership, Behavior Science for Navigating Bullshit. optimizing performance and avoiding ass clownery, right? And I say the ass clownery, and I put like dollar signs on it, and the dollar signs are to remind people that there's a cost to bad leadership, right? In education, there's a cost to student achievement. There's an actual cost to teacher turnover, $20,000 to $30,000 per teacher. There's a cost to your economy. There's a cost to, you know, welfare, you know, because so many students are going on welfare, mental health issues, incarceration. I believe that educators are the backbone of our nation. I believe that as behavior analysts, we have the tools to help them. But too often, I think in our coursework to become a behavior analyst, because so much of it is focused on an individual with special needs, and thank goodness it is there for that, we forget about the generalization of the science. So people only see it very narrow in its approach. And therefore, when things happen outside of that context, we forget about applying it, right? And I've done it all the time. So the ass clown, it's not name calling. It actually is a response class. It's a class of behaviors. It's an acronym for something. And I say that it's just behavior, though, because I've certainly engaged in lots of ass clown behavior. I've recently caught myself engaging in ass clown behavior. I'm like, what am I doing? That's my own criteria. And I'm doing it right now, you know, and I didn't mean to. We respond emotionally, you know, and that's okay. We got to forgive ourselves for that. But I think that we got to make sure that we remain in touch with our values, right? And we take a look at our behavior and we compare it to what our values are, right? And even though if we feel emotional, we need to go back up into that top right-hand corner of the matrix. I love the ACT matrix, right? And we need to figure out what we need to do more, less, or differently. And so, you know, I am so passionate about helping leaders in education. And I don't think leadership is about title. I believe teachers, we want to help them be leaders. I believe that, you know, anybody that's outside the class, we want to help students be leaders, right? And so I've been able to define it through my own lens. So of course, it's through a behavior analytic lens, but how I believe, like, there's four hats of leadership, right? So it's going to make sense for the teacher. I hope it makes sense for you, for the teacher, for the school leader, for the district leader, for state leaders. There's a lot of ass clownery going on up at the state level, believe me. So it's four hats, right? So one is the leading hat through the four-term contingency, right? And the leading hat is a motivating operation, right? It's really establishing operation. It's creating a want, right? When somebody's down, they're not motivated, right? We got to create a want for them, right? You know, we don't want to force people to do things, because if you force compliance on people, and every once in a while you might need to, right? Let's say kids got a bad tooth and they don't want to go to the dentist, right? And the septus could set in, right? And so, and you've done your best to set it up, right? So they're going to go, we set up some powerful reinforcement, like, hell no, I'm not going. Like, man, this could be like a life or death thing, right? So at some point, but you better make sure that if you use any sort of coercives, you get them in touch with some sort of powerful, positive reinforcement, right? As soon as possible, you get that behavior going. But I don't believe we start there. I believe that that is a last resort, right? So, but we, with a good leading hat on, that has a value in behavior altering effects. Does that make sense? So teachers need to do it, right? School leaders, right? And that's a hard thing to do, right? It's certain behaviors, your tone of voice, right? Creating that want, rallying the troop, and that's powerful. But that's not enough, because that's still an antecedent strategy. And while it has value in behavior altering effect, we've got to get behavior in touch with reinforcement. So the next hat, and usually I turn my hat to the side, but I can't with my headset on, right? Just so it's in memory, is the training hat. And training is about skill acquisition. So we might create a want for people to move in that direction, but we got to make sure that they have the knowledge and skills to be successful. Now, we end up training people, but we don't train them well. You know, if we're a behavior analyst, we could train them well. We know how to train people well, but training is, we need it. Not everybody needs to be trained, because the issues aren't always a skill acquisition or a skill deficit, but we need to know how to have that hat on. It doesn't mean we have to directly train somebody, but it means if we're like in maybe a school leadership position, we have to make sure that we have a system that supports our educators with the training they need, right? Or in the classroom, that teacher puts on the leading hat and they create a want for the students of the lesson. They put on the training hat to give them the knowledge and skills to do it. But here's where the rubber meets the road. I have two more hats to go through. The coaching hat, right? So we're training hats about skill acquisition. The coaching hat is about the generalization of learned skills into natural environment, right? This is where we help people to behave well enough and long enough that they get in touch with some sort of positive reinforcement, naturally occurring positive reinforcement. So if we train a teacher in something, we create a want for them, we train them in it, and now we got to help them do that thing in the natural setting. And so they're seeing, like, wait, the kids are learning more. They're behaving better. My job's easier. Big reinforcer for them. They deserve for that to happen, right? And so our job is to connect their behavior with that result in all these cases, right? Does that make sense so far? So we got the leading hat, training hat, coaching hat, and the final hat. And this is the hat most people skip to. And this is the hat that usually doesn't work because there's not a good system in place. That's the managing hat. And the managing hat is about maintenance, right, of the behavior, right? And to maintain behavior, if you have a good system that has good contingencies in it, and good systems are deliberately developed to deliver positive reinforcement for value out of behavior, right? So that classroom leader creates a want for the, let's say it's classroom manager, creates a want for following expectations, trains the students in expectations, coaches them, right? They use a token system briefly, right? Says, hey, this is all the good things, right? And then they let their system do the maintenance for it, right? They maintain the behavior with that. And as you do good, here's what happens. You do bad. Everybody knows how we're going to correct the behavior. You do it in a way that teaches, in a way that's helpful, right? But you let your system do the work for you. Unfortunately, too many people don't have a good system, or they're not using the system effectively because they're relying on coercives. And from my perspective, the punishment word has become a really bad word, and rightfully so, because people overuse and misuse, right? But by nature, punishment isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? It's the misuse and overuse in the absence of a environment that's richly positively reinforcing for value added behavior. So if I correct somebody doing math, I'm like, hey, don't do it that way. That's going to give you the wrong thing. Try it this way. And they don't do it that way anymore. They do it that way. That's great. It's helpful. You would like it, you know? So I just stop one behavior and I reinforce another. There's nothing wrong with that. And if you have that kind of environment where you can stop a behavior, you can reteach something else, nobody minds that. Issue is, and that's a punisher. The issue is that the term punishment has been paired with a lot of coercive, aversive stuff, you know, and it's been used that way. But we got to think from scientifically what it actually is and why it's not working. It's the misuse and overuse in an environment that's not richly positive reinforcement for value added behavior. So those are the four hats that I believe all leaders need to have. And I believe that, and if you work for any school leader, any district leader, any leader anywhere, they've got to know when to shift those hats, and they've got to create a system that supports that, because especially in schools or any organization, the leader is responsible, right? The leader up the hierarchy, like the CEO, the principal, for developing, right? Involving the stakeholders, because we always want to involve the stakeholders in that classroom. That classroom leader needs to involve the stakeholders, which are the students, and developing the expectations, developing the reinforcement, and developing the corrections for behavior, right? So we want to involve our people all the time, because if they author things, they will own it. And too often, this stuff is done unilaterally, right? People are making decisions for others, and like, man, we got to have input from people. So that is like what's at the essence of positional authority and leadership. And it's all driven, by the way, the background of systems are developed using values. Values are number one. Values should drive the systems. Values drive the behaviors, which systems are made up of processes. Processes are made up of tasks. Tasks are made up of behavior, but they should be grounded in values. When Anika and I go out, that's my colleague. I don't know if you know her, but when we go out and we work with school districts, we start with values. We literally use the ACT matrix. We look at shared values. We help people talk about what's showing up for you. What concerns do you have, you know, and what behaviors are you engaging in, or when you feel that way, and are those aligned with your values or not? And what should we do? And we start to find out a lot of things, right? Things that they know, things that they don't know. And then we can start pinpointing some of the more important behaviors, the replacement behaviors, because I'm not an ACT specialist at all. There's people that are just brilliant and that I know very little about RFT, but I see the ACT matrix as a very important and simple tool. And I just look at it behaviorally, right? The bottom right-hand corner, we could say very simply, it's a preference assessment, right? We might call it a functional response class, you know? And the bottom left-hand corner, are you familiar with that matrix, by the way?
Yeah.
In the bottom left-hand corner, it's like a self-functional behavior assessment, right? And the top left-hand corner are the behaviors that we engage in, right, that we want to replace, right? So we're assessing ourselves and why we're doing that. And the top right-hand corner is our behavior intervention plan. And we need to be aware that when we feel this way, we behave that way. Yeah, these are covert behaviors. And we need to initiate the right behaviors, right? And those pinpointed behaviors, and they got to be the right behaviors. If we behave well enough and long enough, we're going to produce valued outcomes if they're truly our values, right? And probably all those feelings are going to start to go away. That teacher's that's upset about student behavior. You do these things, you engage them, you establish yourself as a positive reinforcer, you set expectations, you know, you correct them privately, you focus on the 4-to-1s, you do that, and kids are going to behave better. They're going to learn more. Your job's going to be easier. And all those feelings of anxiety and the feelings, I can't do this, et cetera, begin to go down. But it's all about, you know, getting people to behave, you know. And if they're not doing that, again, we got to figure out why. And that's where the leadership hat comes on. So I just gave you a lot of information. Man, I just dumped. Do you have any questions about it? Comments?
I am always here for info dumping. So thanks for that. I've got a whole page of notes. Okay. So yeah, I really am. You know, I really appreciate you kind of sharing your, you know, all the way back in childhood. What was that thing that was happening in your life that kind of fuels your passion? Because I think that sometimes, you know, we lose that in this professional context is, you know, rewind. What are those, you know, adverse childhood experiences that kind of created the us who we are, right? Those environmental contexts. And so I really appreciated just kind of hearing that. So thank you.
Yeah, by the way, I went to social work first. I went to social work because my value is helping people. Mm-hmm. I love helping people. And when I stumbled across behavior analysis, I'm like, holy shit, there's a science for helping people, right? Oh my gosh, right? Because I always thought social workers are heavy in heart and light in science. And for a long time, I felt our field, and I think we're making a shift now, was light, that was heavy in science and light in heart, right? But when I look at it, I think we're like the Tin Man. We've always had the heart. The heart is the science. This is the way that we can help people, right? And we can help people anywhere that they're behaving. So I think we've always had it. We just need to use it right, because the science is just the science.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, to that point, I started in reverse. My background and, you know, undergrad was in neurobiology. So I was studying the brain and kind of the, you know, what's happening at a, you know, a cellular level and within those systems. And then went into education and studied behavioral science and was able to really, you know, understand kind of the science of behavior and why we do the things that we do and why we don't do things that we, you know, maybe, you know, quote unquote, should be doing or could be doing better. And then, you know, I made this shift kind of out of clinical practice because there was this kind of cognitive dissonance of like, you know, the ideals that we learn in our graduate programs and then on the ground, what's really happening in the world right now. And that big discrepancy. And I needed, you know, I wanted to take that step back and really kind of dove into the world of social justice. And because knowing that, you know, there are people who are behavioral scientists who have worked in this area and understanding that behavioral science can be, you know, applied to so many different things aside from kind of the core of, you know, what most people do now is kind of disability education. But then I started actually looking at the ethical codes for all these different professions and the social worker, you know, ethical code. I was like, yeah, like that's the language though, right? So it's like we as behavioral scientists, like you said, using the word punishment, it has all of these connotations and contexts and people are kind of like, I don't really like that. It's kind of makes me feel yucky. Yeah. But it's like as a behavioral concept, like once you understand it, you're like, I get it. I can remove the emotionality from it. But what I saw from social workers is like they use the language that I think really touched people's lived experiences where, you know, I kind of feel this really nice, you know, potential marriage between the two, you know, and then sprinkle a little public health in there.
I'm going to drop a link in here right now, maybe drop in the show notes. So a few years back, and because there's been a, you know, I think we're making a shift in the science, right? And I'm like, I don't know. For me, it's, I've always just been compassionate. You know what I mean? There's not like, that's just me. It's my value. I've always wanted to help people. And I've saw the science as a way to do it, right? And so, but I think some people were so, again, I think it's come through our training that we're so just wanting to do the science right and forgetting about this is the science of human behavior. If we're operating with, you know, with people, and that we've got to establish ourselves as a reinforcer, right? We got to find out, we need to involve people. We got to be kind of, they need to walk away feeling good about what's happened with the science. And so I've always believed big time in social validity. Like a lot of my writing, for example, at the leadership level, and you know this to be true, Abby, because you work in education. Yeah, they have social validity. They call it, it's a climate survey. They give it at the end of the year. I call it a friggin' autopsy. It's too late to do anything about that. That data should be looked at regularly, and it should not be used to punish the principal. It should be used to support them, to coach them, right? To look at norms, to figure out what they're doing well and to help them be better. But too often it's used to beat them up. But it's the same thing at the classroom level. And that is, there should be sociability for the students. Simple questions like, do you feel safe? Do you feel cared for? You know, do you feel engaged by the work? And never to beat the teachers up. They're getting beat up plenty, right? We need to have an environment where we can set them up to be successful. And we're not doing that from higher ed down. Too many teachers are being dropped into the classroom unprepared to meet the demands of it, right? Like, for example, only 1 in 3 are even, the last I looked, maybe somebody has some new research on it, right? But the last I looked, only 1 in 3 universities even teaches classroom management. But most teachers leaving the field are claiming 3 things. 1, lack of perceived support from the administrator, right? And I'm saying perceived because it's all our perception anyhow, right? But I can imagine that. 2, feeling unprepared to meet the demands of the classroom. And 3, behavior challenge, right? And I can tell you that from the leadership one, I've taught as a faculty leadership, and it's all theory. And theory does not generalize into real world, right? It does not generalize. I can't give my fighters theory and expect that they're going to perform in there. And when they're not performing in the fight, then I'm judging them. I'm evaluating them. I'm telling them they need to do something more or less or differently. They're going to fall back onto the habits that keep them safe. And there's actually research that talks about this in education. It's outside of the behavior analytic field, but it makes sense. It's in my upcoming book, Deliberate Coaching, my second edition. But Sage is concerned with saying that, like, you can't expect that teacher to innovate if, like, they're barely surviving. We can think of that as a hierarchy of reinforcers, you know what I mean? Help them to survive first, support them, but we need to equip them. But now come back to our own field. And we get a lot of theory, right? This is my opinion, we need simulations. And we need simulations that allow us to take a principle and generalize it across context, because the principles are just the same. And so we need to break people out of this behavior myopia that we're all suffering from, because I got to check myself with it all the time, right? And make sure that we're always keeping on our behavioral lens. Because if you believe in the science, there's no reason to take it off, right? And if you have your values, making sure that you're engaging in behaviors that are aligned with your values, not doing it in the name of, you cannot treat your colleague poorly because they're not producing the outcome that you want for the learner, right? You shouldn't be shaming them. You should be doing this. There's a reason why they're not doing it. Why? And this is where the 4 hats comes on, right? And what are you going to do more or less or differently? So I have an ass clown story about myself for the district. Now I was turning around schools and I wanted to go back because I had worked at district level and somebody, you know, like what I found was I wasn't getting street cred because I wasn't an administrator. I ended up taking on the job as an assistant principal. They dropped me, of course, into the alternative school. Within 3 months, we had dropped their major behavioral issues down by like 72%. I say like, because I don't have the data right in front of me. But then mid-year, and they'd never done this before, they popped me out of that school and dropped me into the worst school in the district. Believe it or not, the alternative school wasn't the worst school. It was a Title I school, high poverty, elementary school, and the cops were being called out there twice a week. And Abby, within 2 months, the local and the state union rep came out and declared it a miracle. I'm like, it's not a miracle. It's a science, human behavior. It's not me. It's just a science. It's organizational behavior management. So we can be equipped with the science, but we're not thinking about it, right? Outside of, again, working with people with special needs. And so this is why I believe simulations is how we connect the dots. In my world, in the fight world, simulations are sparring, right? It's the place to safely learn. I'm not saying fighting is safe any time, right? But safely learn where you can get feedback. And if you do it right, I can try, I call it prescriptive sparring. So if you're learning like to throw a jab and a slip, for example, I'll put you in the cage, but I'm not going to have the fighter throw all their repertoire at you, right? I'm going to have your opponent throw just one punch, and they're going to throw it at like 20%. And now that gives you the ability, once you can demonstrate the skill competently outside of the cage of the ring, now you can perform it under semi-live conditions, right? And now I'm getting you in touch with reinforcement. You're avoiding the punches. You're in a position to throw your own punch. And then we start to up the speed, and then we start to layer back in some of the other punches. So I'm helping you perform successfully and relatively safely under these conditions that are as close as possible to the real world. So when you do enter the real world, in this case, it's the real fight, you're going to be far more likely to perform successfully because now we've created habit strength behavior. And we're not doing that. I'm not saying you have to have, we have gamification. We can do virtual reality, right? There's all sorts of things that we can do through simulations to give people high repetitions and give them lots of how to use data and feedback to help them perform better and give them the reason why they made the mistakes, right? Give them the why and develop competency and fluency with key behavior principles, right? Especially in situations like consulting, because none of us get trained in consulting. That's why Nika and Matt Sikori and I started the Behavior Toolbox to teach people how to consult in schools, because we effed up all sorts of things, right? We went in the classroom, we sat in the back, we just collected data. You know, the teachers didn't, I got kicked out of a classroom before. I thought I was doing behavior analysis, but that's the teacher's home. I should have been going in there starting with the principal and find out what their reinforcers are, meeting with the teacher to find out what their reinforcers are. I should know how to engage in good question asking strategies like motivational interviewing, right? To find out what their reinforcers are, what's blocking their access to the reinforcers, find out what other implications of that are, and get them to guide how I'm going to support them. But of course, I got to make sure that there's a system for doing that, and that everybody understands the systems, because for behavior analysts, as you know, our challenge is that people think we're going to come in and we're going to fix the behavior, right? What they don't realize in education is that it's really their behavior that we're changing if we want any sort of sustainability, right? And this is why I make the plea to behavior analysts that every behavior analyst out there needs to understand organizational behavior management, because once you're trying to get change through the behavior of others, you are now in the realm of OBM, right? And you think about that classroom as an organization, that teacher's like the CEO, those students are a bunch of, employees trying to get, this business result that we call student achievement. And this is why we need to understand this stuff, right? And with OBM, it means you have to have soft skills. You need to know how to interact with people, and you need to know how to create a want, put on those four hats that I talked about. Because without those things, you might be doing it in right, and you might have, right on your side, your values are right. But what you feel doesn't matter, right? I mean, your intention is important, but you got to think about how we're impacting others. So in my ass clown behavior, when I got dropped in those schools, I ended up leaving because the district wouldn't listen to me, right? So very frustrating, right? I'm like, they don't freaking listen. They're not doing it. I'm dipping. And I'm glad I ended up leaving, because I ended up going a different route, right? But I look back, I think about I wasn't showing up at their functions. I wasn't establishing myself as a positive reinforcer. I wasn't finding out what their pain points are, which are the reinforcers, right? They're, where they want to get away from the negative reinforcers. I wasn't finding out what their positive reinforcers are. Again, I was thinking, I'm not going to kiss their butt. I don't care about moving up, right? So I wasn't engaging the behaviors that were required to help them maybe open the doors for applying OBM across the district. So I was definitely suffering from behavior myopia, and I was engaging in ass clown behavior because I was blaming them. And I think we've all done this, right? Just behavior. We've all done this, because if somebody's not doing something, there's a reason why. And getting pissed at them, yelling at them, telling them they're bad, this and that and the other, or thinking it, it's really a waste of time. Whatever I wasn't doing wasn't working. So what do I need to do more, less, or differently to make a change? And that starts with knowing what the reinforcers are. That makes sense? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. All of this is really resonating with me. And, thinking about my, what I'm currently doing, and what I really see as an opening for behavioral scientists who have felt really pigeonholed into, education, special education, clinical work. Right now, I'm actually working with a team with a health network where we're actually trying to develop a integrated healthcare system that serves the people on our island, which are, it's a very large island with a small population. And what I, what I'm running up against is this, is exactly what you're talking about, is like, I'm coming in and wanting to, shift behavior, make significant systemic changes, but haven't done the work yet to build those strong relationships and connections. And where I wanted to the last kind of thread that I would like to pull on has to do specifically with leaders who are neurodivergent or leaders who are working with those who are neurodivergent, who kind of like might have some behavioral tendencies that might not make sense to kind of the, you know, average person. But it's the reality of, you know, where I live, most of the people have experienced a significant amount of trauma. They are, you know, they have, things have not been diagnosed. They're dealing with chronic pain. They have all of these, you know, intersecting issues that really haven't been addressed. And so that's kind of, you know, yeah, thinking about how we as leaders in behavioral science who are trying to kind of cross the divide into more systems change, like how might we kind of be able to not just think differently, but act differently and kind of show up in these spaces in a way that will build alliances.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And what's great about it is I think the science of human behavior explains it, right? So to me, a good leader, and this is not my word, right? This is Aubrey Daniels. Aubrey Daniels was my guy, you know, he's the father of OBM. Is that, you know, what separates great leaders is the intentional search for the impact of their behavior, right? So if we look about change as being data, right? Somebody's not doing what we want them to do. We need to reflect on what am I going to do more or less or differently, right? Because we really value the outcome. We have to engage the people. Now, what those behaviors are, there's lots of amazing books on it. Well, of course, I'm going to say, you know, hey, pick up my book because I talk about some key things. One of the key things, if you're a leader, is that you need to involve your stakeholders, which means if you have neurodivergent stakeholders, involving them means getting their input, right? Because good leadership is going to support diversity and inclusion, right? They're going to reduce coercive approaches to the minimum because they're going to have a system that delivers, that's set up to deliver positive reinforcement for value-added behavior. They're going to encourage critical thinking, right, through this feedback because they're going to understand they don't have all the knowledge, right? They don't have all the answer to everything. But the great thing about the science of behaviors, even though we can't, it doesn't give us all the answers, it can help us to find the best ones. And I think we need to realize that. And so I think that's whether you are a leader with people on your staff who are neurodivergent or you're neurodivergent, you still need to think about the outcomes of your behavior, right? The impact of your behavior. And so what do I need to do more, less, or differently if you want to achieve those? And I think I still come back to what are our shared values, right? I love the ACT matrix with Kevin Polk. I've written about it in one of my books. I did an article. It's a free article online about it. It's awesome. Anika and I are going to put it in our next book on quick responses. But I think and live in this. To me, the Hexaflex is too sophisticated. Maybe I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, you know, but I believe that complexity is the enemy of execution, scalability, and sustainability. Everybody can think in these four boxes. And when you use the four boxes, the bottom right-hand corner, say, what are our shared values? What's showing up for this? And we're getting people involved and hearing from them. And what do we do? All right, and collectively, what do we need to do that's going to move us towards these shared values? And we bring it back to behavior. So we bring back the behavior, whether you're neurodivergent or not, it's still going to come down to those behaviors, right, that we agree on. And that should start to produce those outcomes. And when you start producing value and outcomes, man, people like to win, you know? And winning together is a real positive reinforcement that gels a team. And now, one of the things that you need to take pressure off yourself and your team around you, we're always looking at result data. And it's going to take, Abby, whatever you're doing, it sounds like it's large. It's going to take a long time probably to produce that outcome, okay? Which means that you have to find leading indicators. Now, I'm going to give you a quick example of this. Do we have time or would you, I don't want to go over the time here.
Yeah, we're good. We're good on time.
Okay. All right. So, because this is important for anybody. It's important for you. I want people to be successful. I really do, man, especially when you're trying to do good in the world. And it's important to outline a path to success. So here's the example. I'm going to do just a everyday example. Then I'm going to do a school example. And then I think it'll make sense. Now, imagine that you had agreed to drive a car across country. Okay. And you're going to report out how well you were doing, right? There's data, the KPIs. But the person who hired you says that, you know, that you need to report out on miles driven, right? That makes sense, right? Every 200 miles, that's a KPI. You're going to report that out. But you get to the car and it's not built. There's no, the tires aren't on it. There's no upholstery. The steering wheel's not on it. The carburetor's not on it or whatever. So if you're being judged on miles driven, it looks like you aren't doing anything, right? Or if you're being driven by getting to the destination, it, you know, you, thank goodness they're even trying to look at miles driven, right? That's more of a lagging indicator. That's some data. Some people only look at the destination, like, why aren't you there yet? Why aren't you there yet? Why aren't you there yet? Well, hold on. We're working hard. We have a number of accomplishments that we produce. We got the tires on today. We got the upholstery in today. The next day, we got the steering wheel on. Then eventually, you know, we get on the road. If we pinpointed the right behaviors for doing that stuff, the car should be driving. Now we can report out these other indicators in terms of miles. That, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So in everyday, right, systems, you have to connect results with behavior, right? This Thomas Gilbert's work in human competence. And I talk about this in positional authority and leadership. It's really important, right? So at the end of the day, what's an accomplishment? What's at the end of the week, what's an accomplishment? Now, an accomplishment, and we'd have to operationalize this, is a relationship sometimes. In other words, imagine going to consult with a teacher, but you don't have a relationship with them. You're probably going to engage in some sort of course of behavior of trying to get them to do something, right? So having relations, like in sales, for example, you know, making sales, the first thing you do is build relationships with people. Salespeople get it, right? And we kind of are in sales. We're not selling used cars. We're trying to sell behavior change, right? And we're trying to get them to do it through the signs of human behavior. So we got to find these accomplishments. Now, in the school example, as I mentioned, imagine we're trying to reduce suspensions. We're doing just school, something school, right? Suspensions are an issue. We are suspending certain populations too much, and we want to reduce those. Now, if we went to school and we're like, all right, how are we going to do this? And we did an assessment. We're like, wait a second, we have to use the performance diagnostic checklist, and we determine that teachers have no systems in the classroom, right? So there's no classroom management plan. In fact, they've never been trained in classroom management. So an accomplishment would be the number of teachers trained, right? Or we can go before that. It could be getting the training on the schedule. It could be developing the training, getting the training on the schedule, right? It could be the number of teachers that showed up, the number of teachers trained, the number of classroom management plans completed, the number of expectations that have posted. Each one of these becomes an accomplishment, a data point, right? A behavioral roadmap that leads us to this destination, the number of students that can now tell you what the expectations are. And if we pinpointed the right behaviors, right, and we're producing these early accomplishments, these results, we should then begin to start to see a decrease in those suspensions, right? So pinpointing becomes very important, but having some sort of metric with a tight feedback loop, because these feedback loops are so delayed. And if we've outlined these accomplishments, then we make progress salient. And we need progress salient because you as a leader can now reinforce them. That's great. And now you can report up to the higher up saying they're making progress. No, I know it's not good, but look at all the accomplishments that we produce. You feel good about it. Your team feels good about it, right? And they also know that there's progress being made. And you've all agreed on upfront, if you've done it right, because you've engaged the stakeholders. You've all agreed in the goals, right? You've agreed in the accomplishments that's supposed to happen. You've agreed in a feedback loop process, right? I'm going to self-monitor and report out on these intervals, and you're going to get feedback. You know, you're engaging in 4-to-1s, right? You're asking good questions. All these pieces of the puzzle of leadership are going to get you moving in the right direction if you pinpoint the right behaviors. Does that make sense? And this is powerful for anybody to learn, especially if you're trying to make any change at any scale, which it seems like you are.
Yeah. So kind of what I hear you saying is that, you know, it's important to have the big, you know, the big, hairy, audacious goal in mind. Where do we want to get, right? What's our end goal? Mm-hmm. But we also have to need to have small steps that are, that we can track on the short term to help us identify and reinforce ourselves and each other for successive approximations to the goal, right? We're closer and closer to the end goal. We're not there yet, but we've all agreed that if we want to get there, these are the things that we need to do. And if we're doing these, we can trust that, you know, we'll get there eventually.
That's it. If you target the right behavior, you pinpoint the right behaviors, you'll get there. I think it's like a grand task analysis. You know what I mean? Well, like, just follow these steps. Right? We're going to chain all this stuff together and eventually we're going to produce a result. But planning the stuff up front and determining and making that progress salient, because nobody thinks about a relationship as an accomplishment, right? And so we have to think about what are the accomplishments and how are we going to measure these things? And then once we know what those things are, then there's the feedback loop. There's a system for measuring that and giving the feedback to people and reinforcing. We want people to report out what they're doing to you. You're reporting out what you're doing to the higher ups, right? And if we're focusing on good questioning and we're using the 4-to-1s, right? Reinforcing and asking questions if something's not going wrong rather than blaming, right? Thinking about it through a behavior analytic lens, you're going to succeed. I mean, I was able to, you know, with a team of people, with OBM, turn around failing schools that nobody was able to do. It wasn't me. It was OBM, right? And if I can do it, I am nothing special. I just leveled, like, I leveraged just a teaspoon. There's so many more behavior analysts that are so much more brilliant than I am, right? I'm not even in the brilliant phase, right? I just stayed consistent with it. I never believe in myself, Abby. I never did. But I do believe in the science, right? And if I stick to these principles, I find that it almost always leads me in the direction that I want to go. And if I don't, it means I just pinpointed the wrong behavior. And what do I need to do more, less, or differently?
Yeah. I really love that. I really love how you framed that, your, you know, the different kind of aspects that lead, you know, that go into good leadership, creating that want, the training, the coaching, and the managing those different, the different hats.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? It makes it simple.
Yeah. And starting with the values, I think that's really important, you know, and like you said, you know, the Hexaplex, I think people get wrapped too, you know, a little wrapped up in the details, but going back to that, you know, the 4-part ACT matrix to break things down, center your values and identifying what you, you know, want to do more, less, and differently. I really like that, that framework. So I really appreciate you offering that up here.
I dropped an article I wrote many years ago. So I dropped it in the comment section, right? It's called Fighting Words in ABA. So before there was like a lot of vocal people about like the way we communicate with other fields, I thought I was going to get lambasted. I thought people were going to jump all over me, you know, tell me I was a bad person, leave the field. I think one person said it, you know, but all I said was like, we need to play better with other people. We need to communicate more in a way that they understand. And I felt like sometimes we were building walls that keep other people up. It was like classism in fields. And, you know, but since then I've come across a whole bunch of people that I respect so much that are doing a lot of good with the field, right? They're modeling good behavior, right? They're reinforcing. They're not just talking about reinforcement being important, right? They're engaging the behaviors that are reinforcing, because I hear a lot of people saying, well, you know, we shouldn't use punishment. We shouldn't be coercive, but as soon as something doesn't go their way, they're hurling coercives, right? They're being punishing and they're trying to punish it. And so again, I think it's good people. They're suffering from behavior myopia, right? Engaging in bad behavior, but for the right reasons, right? With good intentions. So I think we just, if we keep our behavior analytic lens on, I think we'll move in the right direction. I think we are. I think we're just, you know, there's just stuff going on. But back to schools, man, if we use OBM in these schools, we can make a huge difference. So I dropped that article in there. I'd love for people to leave comments, drop it. And I dropped the link to my latest book.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I'll definitely put those in the show notes for everybody to check out. And I'll just kind of, I'll end on this and, or, you know, just from my perspective. And then I want, you know, I'd love to hear, you know, if you had like one piece of advice for emerging leaders or leaders to kind of, to simmer on, that'd be great. But I got feedback from, you know, I'm always looking for and accepting feedback and trying to figure out how to do better. And from a colleague recently, they said, I want to hear your opinion on this, or I want to hear your side of this, but not as a scientist, as a friend. And I was like, ooh, okay. That is really telling me like how I'm showing up. Like I'm thinking, right? My intention is loving, caring, we're friends, we're in this together. And they're clearly telling me like, you're showing up like is very, you know, pedantic and, you know, sciencey and professorial, and you know, you maybe need to think about, you know, what, like how you're actually showing up.
Well, I think like a scientist, behave like a social worker.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, yeah, and I mean, this is coming from a social worker, you know, so I'm not saying, but you know, like, and I think, you know, the two are a nice mix, because remember, they get a lot of soft skills. And I think a lot of people probably go into our field with soft skills, but it's almost like they get conditioned out of them just because we're so focused on the science. And this is the greatest science in the world for making a positive difference. So I think we're learning more about that. There's more talk about compassion in the way that we approach things, right? But we just got to keep the behavior analytic lens on. I think, you know, for yourself, you are trying to help. You're trying to use the science, but we just got to speak in a way, because it's not about you know, I think our intent is important. It speaks to our values, right? I didn't mean for that to happen as long as we're checking it, but still in the end, it's about our impact, right? So it doesn't matter in the end how, what our intention are. We got to take a look at how we're impacting people. And that was nice of your friend to feel comfortable with you to share that with you. That's a measure of you that they felt comfortable enough to give you that kind of feedback, you know? You know, because none of us are perfect. You know, I think the way we give people feedback is really important. I think if we're like coercive with them, we shut doors, and we don't want to shut doors. We're so many, we have so many shared values. And like within our field, like, I wrote an article, by the way, it was about activism and in the field. I encourage you guys to take a look at that. Anybody that's listening to it, it's saying like, guys, we are all in this for the same reason, right? Let's start with the shared values. And where people were saying like ABA is abuse, I'm like, people certainly have been abused using it, but it's just the science, right? It's not the science. Don't get rid of the science. Let's focus on developing people better so they can use the science effectively, because people have been abused everywhere, in any field with anything, right? This is the science of helping people. And if we tell people that the ABA itself is abusive, we could be hurting a lot of people, because the science has helped people. How can I have possibly helped all these kids and these teachers if I didn't have the science? So let's focus on the right thing. I think we should be advocating for better training, better coaching with it, right? Let's get people, let's get universities to embed what I was saying earlier, simulations in their training, so people are more prepared, because we have a lot of people coming in the field, they're well-intended, but they're taking a beating the way my fighters were doing when they weren't trained well. Not my fighters, other fighters. I don't do that to them, you know? And then they're resorting to, they're falling back onto bad habits instead of falling back onto the science. And it's good people engaging in bad behavior, because we have not set them up for success well enough. So my personal opinion on that.
Yeah. Well, Pauly, this has been wonderful. It's been so good to talk to you, get to know you a little bit. We don't know each other. You know, we're friends on Facebook and, you know, in the same professional circles, but
so we chewed on some of the same dirt in education, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're ever interested in coming back on and sharing what you're up to, I would happily have you here. And with that, we'll sign off.
Thanks, Abby.
All right.